Hi there, and welcome back to the Energy Sector Heroes podcast. My name is Michelle Fraser, and every week I will speak with incredible people who share their lessons, experiences, and stories from their time spent in the energy sector. Hi there, and welcome back again to this week's episode. If you're new to the show, then please take a second to subscribe and even consider sharing the show with just one other person. This week I'm joined by Ray Ruddock. Ray is currently retired, and he's previously an MD at CNOC. Ray, would you like to add anything to your introduction, please?
No, that's how it stands. I am retired. I stepped down and did a little bit of consultancy work after 2020, and I decided to put a stop to that. I was getting sucked back in. So the vast majority of my time now is spent with charities and mentoring within the industry and mentoring outside the industry as well. And I do have an involvement of one or two small companies, but that will come to a natural end probably within the next year. So it's for me, it's about trying to give back a little bit because I benefited greatly from the industry over the years. So you try and give back, and you try and mentor companies, mentor individuals. Whether I help or not, that's for them to decide.
I'm probably sure. I'm pretty sure that you probably do help an amazingly amount. So how did you actually get started in the energy sector?
Well, I became aware, and this was in I was interviewed for a BBC Alba documentary, and it's a good documentary, and it's basically roughly translated from the Gaelic. It's when oil came to Aberdeen. And I can recall in that interview saying I first became aware of oil and gas because of one of the very, very early Offshore Europe exhibitions. And I went out there on the bus with a couple of mates, and I was blown away. And then Robert Gordon's Institute of Technologies, it was in Aberdeen. I'm an Aberdonian born and bred. They started doing sort of offshore-related courses as opposed to the traditional engineering. So I went into RGIT, and whilst there, they put you out in St. Conmont when you were a student. You were a student engineer, and I was in various companies around about Aberdeen. And I thought at the time, this is what I want to get into. And I think most of my generation, as it were, at the time, saw an opportunity to do something different, and I'll be frank, earn money and get overseas at somebody else's cost. And I think many, many people, as I say, of my age group, actually benefited from that. So that's how I got into it. And my first job was with a company that's now defunct. It was OIL Engineering, which was Ocean Inchcape. And I was a young sort of weld inspector, believe it or not, and then a projects engineer with them. And because they were a service provider to the operators, you got a little bit of an insight into just how vast, how challenging, how interesting the industry was. So I'm going back to the very early 80s, 1980. And it was to this day, I would still say it was fantastic. Fantastic.
Okay. So you mentioned that, did you ever work abroad then with any of the jobs?
I'll start from the latest one. My wife and I and two kids went across to Angola with Total. And we were there. I was there for 3.5 years. They were there for 3 years. And it was a fantastic experience. It was a fantastic experience for them. And Angola people immediately think, whoa, what are you doing taking your kids there? But we arrived just at the end of the 29-year civil war. And I was out there when the war actually finished. And I started to look around, and I came home and said to my wife, we can do this. And I'm not so sure she was convinced in her first 6 months there, but we had a good time. And I think we matured as a family. You become very much a team when you're in an environment like that. But I certainly you know, every day was a school day when I was out there, just understanding how different offshore oil and gas production was there compared to here. And I also did time in Paris. So maybe at this point, just go through that. When I left OIL, I went into Occidental. And from Occidental, they sold up and Elf bought out Occidental. I decided to stay with Elf as opposed to go with Oxy. And then Total bought out Elf. And in total, that was 27, 28 years service from starting with Oxy all the way through to Total. So it was a big decision to leave and join Nexen. But I decided that I needed a change and went into Nexen, and Nexen were finally bought out by CNOOC. So I've had quite a varied experiences of cultures, you know, going through the American culture and then through the French culture, which was different than Elf and Total, and then into the Canadian culture of Nexen, and then finally into the Chinese culture. So I'm lost. I don't know where the hell I am these days with culture. Whether I'm a Scotsman, an American, a Frenchman, don't know.
Do you really find that working in with different nationalities, that the culture of the company is really hugely different?
Yes, without a doubt. And it's quite interesting how, and I noticed this, some people could adapt to that and understand that there is a different culture here and I need to work within that culture if I'm going to do a good job. Some people could, some people couldn't. But I would, and even at my stage in life with the grey hairs, I would encourage, and I do, when I'm mentoring some of the younger folk that are either graduates within the industry or coming out of their graduate program, maybe 2 or 3 years out, I always say, if you get an opportunity to work overseas, you're going to learn and you should do it and then come back.
Yeah. But some people never come back. I mean, I've worked overseas.
Some people never come back. Yeah.
I've worked overseas quite a few times myself. So, who was your role model and why did you find them inspirational?
Good question. And I've been asked that before. So if I go back to my first proper boss, when you start full-time and you're not a student engineer, a guy called Jim Rourke, who was the MD of OIL Engineering, didn't realise it at the time, but through a process of osmosis, you're getting taught. And you don't understand that. And then I would say the next guy up there, and all of my bosses throughout the year, 9 times out of 10, you know, they were good. They taught you, they brought you on, they gave you experience, they encouraged you. And I'm just picking out the three that really stood out here. Next one would be my last MD at Total, a gentleman called Roland Fester, who'd actually been MD in 5 different countries for Total. So he had a global experience. And he would say to me, I was HSE director at the time, and he would say to me, you're going to London with me. And I would say, I've got a lot on. And he said, you're coming to London with me. And I didn't realise at the time that this process of osmosis, that I would sit in a meeting with him and listen. And then you go away and subconsciously it's going through your head. You know, it's like a washing machine going through your head and you're learning. And the last one that really was standout was the MD at Nexen that I succeeded, a chap called Archie Kennedy. And Archie was, you know, he'd worked overseas. His main career was with Conoco, but he'd worked for other companies. And he came out of retirement, actually, to be MD at Nexen. And again, just this discussion, the chat, even if you're sitting in an airport lounge and you're still speaking about, so what we're going to do here, we've got a challenge here, what do you think? And I would encourage anyone to think at the end of the day, so what did I hear there? And when I stepped down, I was doing a bit of work for another company, and we met with I won't say the organization. And we had dinner and we got back in the group of guys we were working with. And that was the question I put on the table. So what did you hear there? So don't just think it was a dinner and nice wine. In between the lines of conversation, there's something else there. So what did we do? What did we take out of it? Where do we go from it? So those three names, amongst many, they were just up there. They were skilled at it, without a doubt.
Okay. What was the most important thing that you learned from them then?
People. That people count. And that people deliver. And then from my experiences, I've developed a very strong belief that certainly within an operator, 60, 70% of your problems, the solutions are actually in the minds of the employees. And you've got to give them an opportunity to speak. You've got to give them an opportunity to contribute. So for me, those three names that I used, people, they were fantastic leaders. And that's an overused phrase these days, you know, leaders and leadership. But they were good leaders, but they were really good people managers. And they communicated so well. And that would be me. The lessons, people count. And you should respect them and engage with them. Communication. And why not tell them, you know, where the business is and what the finances are, where we're going and what we're doing. Why not tell them? Be as open as you possibly can. There's obviously issues that you can't speak to them about in the business. But at a town hall, I would stand up and say, I'll tell you everything I possibly can, but I won't go into sensitive HR stuff and I won't necessarily go into M&A because that's sensitive areas. Everything else in between, ask away. And I think that's how you get engagement when people will actually... I loved it when you went to the coffee point and you're making yourself, in my case, a cup of tea, and somebody would say to me, that was really interesting, that, but what are we going to do about this? And then you get into a conversation, and what I would say to any up-and-coming senior managers is, if you get in a conversation like that, don't look at your watch. You've probably got a head full of what my diary looks like today, but that conversation is important at that point in time. And give that individual his place, his or her place.
Okay.
But does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. But is that really difficult to do? Because not a lot of managers do that.
Yeah, you have to work at it. You have to really work at it. And, you know, and as I say, when it's a busy world within an operator, and you've got a full-on day, and if somebody sort of high in the corridor and then starts to open up, it's very difficult. You've got to be disciplined to say, I need to do this. And you've got to come up with a mechanism of letting them know that I actually can't do this just now, but you want to come and have a cup of coffee at 4 or tomorrow or whatever. So it's really difficult to do, but you have to work at it. It's something that I always said to some of the guys that were coming through the ranks. You know, don't just think you've got foot soldiers and sergeants there. You've got people, and they understand this business probably more so than I ever did.
Okay. What makes you say that, though?
Because especially, I worked offshore for 10, 11 years. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough to be, in fact, a construction superintendent, then a production superintendent, then an OIM, and an OIM in two installations. And what I saw there was that when folk arrive on day one of their trip, they want to understand where they are. And then they start to say, okay, that's the issue. Let's start solving it. I wouldn't be able to solve it. You know, if it was a instrument issue, I wouldn't be able to solve it. So that's when I say there are many people in organizations, even at the most senior level, understand that if you're the guy at the top, they might know, and they usually do know better than you.
Okay. Do you really think that, though, that the guy above you usually knows more?
Not necessarily the guy above. What I really do think is what I've just said, that give them an opportunity to contribute, because you may not know, you may have an idea of where you're wanting to go and what the solution might be. But in that conversation, you're going to get nuggets. You're going to get gold dust. And that will form your thinking as to where you should go. And I'm not going to say 9 times out of 10. I don't know if it was 5 times out of 10. But I would come out of a meeting having had those conversations and think, okay, we need to think about this and we need to change direction ever so slightly. We need to go around another 10 degrees in the compass and maybe head in that direction for a little while.
Okay. That's an interesting concept. I like it though. So what has been the most challenging thing about your role as a MD?
Oh, juggling balls. Because as an MD, you're both internally facing and externally facing. I had a number of roles in external organizations as well as the one that paid my salary, as it were. And it was juggling. And when you have to be, when you have to be in London Monday, Tuesday, back up to Aberdeen Wednesday, back to London Thursday, and then out to Calgary on a Friday, away for the weekend, you have to have an understanding partner and family. So for me, the challenge was always time. And what do you do with your time? Where do you go? What are the priorities? And sometimes you go to the issues and the places that are not the priority, because you do realise that they've got an importance in their own right. So, for instance, charities. In CNOC, we did a tremendous amount of work, both at a national level and a local level, for charities. They need their place as well. If you're going to encourage them and make sure that the contribution that you're making to those charities are being used in the right way, then they need their place as well. Let me give you an example of that. Outward Bound, we were quite heavily involved with them. And I seconded some of the graduate engineers from the organizations to be trained as Outward Bound instructors. Why did I do that? Because the chap at Outward Bound said to me, why don't you come in one of the Outward Bound courses? And I said, they don't want to listen to an aging, balding, fat guy that's totally out of touch with their reality. What they want to do is speak to a guy that's maybe just a few years older than them, guy or a girl that's a few years older than them. And I picked that up because I sat in a presentation on two separate occasions, and it was two girls in the first presentation and two boys in the following year, in the second presentation. And both of them said that their lives had fundamentally changed as a result of Outward Bound. And that really went deep with me. And that's why you're prepared to release a number of your graduates when they are actually doing good work in the business. But this was important for Outward Bound, but it was important for the graduates as well. And they would come back in and say, that has changed my view. And communication skills were one of the big elements that came out of that. So that's an example of sometimes you have to give the place to some of the other activities. And it may well be a department meeting, their weekly meeting. They want 5-10 minutes of your time just so that they hear what you're thinking at the time. Be prepared to do that.
Okay. So how did, you were saying that the people that you met, they say that their outlook and their life had changed. In what way?
The kids at Outward Bound?
Yeah.
So I'll be very frank. The first girl that stood up, and it was a challenging environment for a 14-year-old girl from a really challenged school in the East End of London. So there were 20 MDs and CEOs in the room and a member of the royal family. And they had to stand up and give a 5-10 minute little talk as to why they believed in Outward Bound. And her opening remark was, if it wasn't for Outward Bound, I'd be in prison, I'd be on drugs, or I'd be a prostitute. And I looked at this girl, and her socks were falling down around her ankles. And I thought, if this organization has changed you as much as that, then we need to get really involved in it. And we already contributed to it, but we got really involved in it. And it wasn't just Outward Bound. It was many other organizations as well, and including local organizations.
I'm speechless, and that's not often, actually. I'm quite surprised in that. But that must be amazing. That must be an amazing feeling to be involved in something like that, too.
Yeah, and I will be frank. I employed a lady whose life's work was in the charity sector, and I employed her because I thought we needed a little bit of strategy into it. I certainly wanted to get control over the budget, because the budget was leaking out of the organisation. And in fact, I'm meeting her for a cup of coffee tomorrow morning to catch up with her. She's now working for another charity organisation. And I need to tap her knowledge as well about a couple of things that I'm doing. But it really started to lift the organisation, because we would speak about what we were doing on the charity side at the town halls. So it was up there with the HSE statistics, it was up there with the production statistics, it was up there with the financials, and then this is what we're doing. And, you know, we'd say we've got a P6 and P7 come in from a local school that is maybe not in the best area of Aberdeen, let's put it that way. And again, I would always say to the graduates, this is part of your project. And they would take them through the day. And you would tell them about the town hall, and you'd be amazed the number of people that actually stuck their head into the room and then actually said, can I help out? So I think if you've got a social responsibility that's so positive and it's a positive culture, it actually helps your business. It lifts the spirits. I really do believe that.
I think so too. I do think so too. So I was going to ask you, when you were working as an MD, for all our younger listeners, what was your typical day? What do you actually, what do you actually do as an MD? But you must do a lot of different things.
You do. And I was very fortunate. And it's hereditary. I don't either. A great deal of sleep. So I was always up early in the morning, as was my father, as was my brother, as is my son, maybe not so my daughter. But so I was always in early. But I was fortunate because there was a number of other people that were senior in the organization were in early as well. So that would, I called it the golden time, where you could actually just sit and have a chat and say, so how did that go yesterday? And how did this? This isn't what I'm going to hear in the meeting later on. How do you think that went yesterday? So that was golden time, you know, between 6:30 and 7:30. But then, to be honest, you got into this hamster wheel of the day, and you know, there's people saying to you, right, there's a car downstairs. You need to get across town. But you need to be back for 2:00 because you've got this meeting, and then at 3:00 you need to, don't run on in that. So you've got people saying that to you, and then I had two wonderful PAs, one in London and one in Aberdeen, and they would actually knock on the door and say, "Ray, stop speaking. You need to get down the corridor." But you need that. They were an intrinsic part of the team because it is hectic. It really is hectic, but you've got to, somewhere along the line, give yourself a bit of thinking space. And I think that's important too. And I was involved in a leadership course many, many years ago. And the chap that was the guy that delivered the course, he actually coached Branson. He was Branson's personal business coach. And he was the guy that said, you need to give yourself thinking time. And he would say, so when's your quiet time in a week? And at this time, my family were still young. And I said to him, between 6 and 7 on a Sunday evening, and I'm usually cooking the Sunday supper and my wife's doing the bath or vice versa. He said, well, take that time. And you need to just reflect on your week that's gone and the week that's ahead of you. So if you're looking for a piece of advice out of there, give yourself some thinking space and be prepared to close the door sometimes and try and stay away from the emails, because they are just a swamp. You know, you get pulled in there. So be very disciplined about what you do with your emails and when. And there was another operator in town, a really good MD, he's long departed Aberdeen. And he would only do emails. He would only look at his emails between 7:30 and 8:30, 12:30 and 1:30, and then 5 and 6. And he would only do it. So if you put an email through to him, you knew you weren't going to get an answer. Everyone expects an answer straight away. You know, and same with WhatsApp or whatever it is. I don't understand social media. But everyone's sort of saying, well, why haven't they answered me? Well, maybe they're doing other stuff that's not quite as important as you. So don't get pulled into the emails is possibly what I would say.
Okay.
Says he who always got pulled into these emails.
That is a good strategy, actually. I would never think about doing that. Because when I'm working, I always, you can get pulled into your emails all the time, I think.
Yeah, very much. It's very easy. And you think, right, I've answered that one. I'll go to the next one now. And it's so easy to do it. It really is. Whereas you should probably take a walk along to the coffee pint, make yourself a cup of coffee, and listen to what's been spoken about there. Because usually what's getting spoken about there, they're wanting you to hear it. I always believe that sometimes you would know that the conversation had changed when you came in about. And if you listened to it, they would be giving you hints about stuff that's gone wrong or stuff that's going on. So, you know, don't get sucked into the next email. Get yourself out into your people.
Okay. But do you really think that especially when the MD is walking around the offices, that when you see him, conversations do change?
Not all the time, but I've got one or two examples, and I have used them in the past, and I've been very public about them, when the conversation's changed, and then you hear, oh, did you hear what happened on that platform at the weekend? And it hasn't actually, and neither should it filter up to the MD, because the operations guys are getting paid to take care of it. So it should filter up to the MDs by exception. You should trust your guys to get after it. But there'd be something, and I can remember one in particular, on a Monday morning, and it was spoken about at the coffee point, which gave me an opportunity very subtly to ask a couple of questions at the weekly meeting. Intelligence gathering, that's what it was.
Is it important to do intelligence gathering, though, as a senior manager?
Yeah. Listen. You know, my father was a very simple man, a tradesman. And he would say there's a good reason why God gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth. You know, that lives with me to this day. My wife might not agree with that, but that's what lives with me to this day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so did you always know that you were wanting to work in the energy sector?
Not until I started going through RGIT. And it was when they started the specialised subjects, such as drilling, for instance, or production technology. It's when that started, as opposed to the traditional. So I'm a mechanical engineer, the traditional mechanical engineering aspects. It's when that started, and I thought, I like this. I do like this. And then, of course, you come out and you're looking for a job, and you realize you're not only looking for a job for a career, you're looking for a job to survive, money. So you look around, and at that time, the biggest industry employer was oil and gas, And many, many, many of us benefited from that.
Do you think so? Because I remember that back in the day, at the start, the oil and gas was huge in Aberdeen.
It was huge in Aberdeen. But again, I come back to the BBC Albert documentary, because it's not about the industry and it's not about oil. It's about society in Aberdeen in the late 70s and 80s, when oil really came to town. And there's a fantastic interview with a young mother, must have been about 1980. And she's actually saying, if you're in oil, you're okay. If you're not in oil, you know, you're broke. And I'd never really thought about that until I actually sat in the documentary and watched it once it was completed.
I have heard of that actually a few times myself. Yep.
And that's why I say I was lucky, and many other people were lucky to actually get a break. That's what it was. It was about getting a break and getting that first job and then doing the best you possibly could in that first job, and then the next week and the next week and the next week.
But do you think it was harder to get into the oil industry back at the start?
No, I think it's harder now. I think it's harder now to get into the industry because there are many, many more graduates coming out. But then the other challenge is, do you want to come into the industry? Because it's fundamentally changed. Society views the industry in a different light now. And I had a really great learning point the year before I retired. And in a town hall, I said that we were launching a conceptual study to look at an offshore wind farm to power up our installations instead of using diesel and gas. And two individuals in their early 30s come to me separately and say, that's fantastic news, because I was in the point of resignation because my moral compass was pointing in the wrong direction. And I started using that phrase, and it really struck me that the younger element of the workforce, I'm saying in their 30s is a younger element compared to me, that they've got a different view on the industry, you know. And I think we've got to acknowledge that. So it's a different industry. I think you will always have a certain element of the graduate population that want to come into it, but it's even hard to get into it for that small group of the population, because there's certainly not as many jobs as there were. There's not as many opportunities as there were. So it is tough to get into it. It really is.
Do you have any advice for any of the younger generation that want to still come into the oil industry?
Yeah, I would say that. So I spoke last week publicly about, I think there's a growing understanding within society that hydrocarbon, oil and gas, is part of the transition to net zero, and that you do need hydrocarbon to get there. So and that would be my first thing. Understand that, you know. Understand that you're not going to be the favourite person in society necessarily. But it's an important deliverable for the UK economy and for the people of the UK. We need energy, we need power, we need manufacturing, we need all of that, especially at a time like this when the economy isn't as rosy as one would hope. So my advice would be understand the context of it. But my other piece of advice would be attitude. You know, always have good attitude about getting to work. And I and this sounds rather glib of me to say that, I can't remember one day that I woke up and I thought, oh God, I've got to go into work. Sounds really glib, but that commitment, that attitude is really important for you to succeed. Because if you haven't got that good mind space, that, I'm going to say, it's not happy, that positive mind space, then you're not going to deliver. So I would encourage them to learn and give their all.
Good advice. Very good advice. So have you had any career disasters, and how did you handle them?
The biggest scar that I carry, and I carry quite a lot of scars, and I've said this over the years, the biggest scar I carry is Piper Arthur. And I was with Occidental at the time as a young engineer. I was actually scheduled to be on it, and the job ran late. And then I was involved in the aftermath. And what would I say about that? Yeah, I've got a scar, but that scar is a good scar because it strengthens you to make good, safe decisions as you go through your working life, and especially if you get into positions of responsibility and understanding the consequences of getting those decisions wrong or the consequences of not standing up and stepping in and saying, stop. So in many ways, it did leave a scar on me. It wasn't a good time of life for me personally. I was pretty young at the time. But when I made OIM, and I was OIM on Piper Bravo, and I was OIM in Clumo before that, but when I made OIM, you know, you remember back to the consequences of when you get it wrong. So that's one of the big scars. I think if you spoke to some of the people that I worked with years ago, they would say I was a little bit too hot-headed. And when I got to retirement, one of them stood up and actually said, you've mellowed so much over the years. So that would be my other learning, as it were. You can be hot-headed when you're young, but if you're wanting to bring people with you, you can't be hot-headed. You've got to be mellow and understanding. No, I'm not mellow all the time. I never was mellow all the time, but I think you have to change and understand. And I think you know, look in the mirror in the morning and say, "Am I going in the right way? Am I doing the right things?"
Do you think that's important to do so?
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether it's oil and gas or whether you're a good friend of mine. He was an Argentinian. I worked with him for many years. And his father used to say to him, you know, if you want to go into oil and gas, fine. But if you want to sell papers on the subway, make sure you're the best paper seller on the subway. So I don't think it matters what industry sector you're in, what you actually do. I do think you should treat people with respect, look at yourself and say, am I doing the right thing? Should I have said that yesterday? And what am I going to do tomorrow to make amends for yesterday if you've screwed up?
Okay. I think that's excellent advice. So I was going to ask you, has been your most challenging day? But you briefly talked about the Piper Alpha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a challenge. But I think at the time I was very much a foot soldier. So I wasn't party to the decisions. I was party to doing some of the work in the aftermath of that. I think the most challenging day I had was, I was operations manager for Elgin Franklin Project. And I'm sure many of your viewers will understand this. Projects are great fun to be in, but projects have got to come to an end. And then operations have to start. Actually, I went out, and I wasn't OIM at the time, I was ops manager, but I went out a couple of days before our planned startup, and I could just sense that there was delays because the guys didn't want to do it. So that was my most challenging one, to bring them on side and then get Elgin Franklin going. I didn't do it. It was just laying out and saying, this is what we're about. You know, the project has to come to an end. And we need to start getting there. And I was getting arguments about, it was late March, and I was getting arguments about, oh, you're pushing us because it's a tax year. And then, you know, when I heard that coming out of the town hall offshore, I thought, I've never thought about that. And you've got to convince them that I've never thought about that. And it's not the issue. So that would have been my most challenging day. Or days, I have to say.
So how would you convince them of what they were thinking was not correct then?
You've got to be, I think, One, you've got to be credible. Two, you've got to be trustworthy. And three, they've got to understand that you're transparent and that you're sharing with them your own views on it. And I think the other thing at that time was, you know, getting across to them that I'm as much an employee as you are. You know, so yeah, we're all in this. And again, it sounds rather glib, but we are all in this together. So I'm not standing here in a soapbox saying you will do this. I'm trying to explain why we will do this. And that's two fundamentally different positions to take.
Okay. Excellent. I was going to ask you, so in your opinion, what makes an outstanding hire? What do you look for if you were going to hire someone?
Attitude. Without a doubt, attitude. Positive, good attitude. You know, they can't get beyond that. You know, what you get in a CV in front of you isn't what you get sitting in front of you. So test them on their attitude. Test them on their I don't mean beliefs as in religion, but their beliefs about what they're going to do if they were to get that job. So for me, it's always, always attitude.
But how do you test someone on your attitude, though?
You just let the conversation flow. Don't dominate the conversation. Don't pepper them with a million questions. But give them enough spicy questions that they have to react to.
Okay. So what's the most spicy question that you've asked on an interview then?
I said to one guy, and he was straight out of university. And I did say to him, I'm trying to remember what position I had at the time. I think it was probably ops manager. And he was at the interview. So what would he have been, 22, 23? And he said, I want to be an OEM by the time I'm 28. Far too young. So I say, far too young. What next? And he said, from an OEM, and I will be an OEM at 28, I'm going to be after your job. I said to him, and I actually took off my shoes. And I said, do they fit you? Because you've got a long way to go. And that changed, because I'd made a little bit of humour, it changed him totally. And he realised that he was wrong, and he said, if I were to get this job, I'd be looking for this. I'd be looking for a mentor. I'd be listening. I want time to understand the business. And that's the other thing for me is don't necessarily get yourself locked down into a narrow alley or another narrow optical alley. You know, be prepared to ask questions and understand the business.
I was going to wait to say it. That is quite a bold statement to make that they were going to be after your job, especially as MD. That is quite a bold statement.
That's why I took the shoes off and said, can you fill them? And he, you know, this, did I do the right thing? If I was doing it today, would I do that? Probably not. But I was a lot younger at the time. And as I say, I was an ops manager at the time. And it served its purpose, but I don't think you'd be allowed to do something like that these days.
No, I don't think so either, actually.
You'd probably get sacked.
It's a very good response, though. Mm. I did like that. I was going to ask you maybe a couple more questions. What motivates you to keep going when times get tough?
So you should probably address that question to my last senior management team. And this is going to sound very, very egotistical, but I just wanted the company to be the best it could be under my direction at the time, knowing that an MD's always got a finite period of time. You know, an MD has always got a finite period of time. I wanted to make it the number one operator in the North Sea. I wanted it to be the best, but not only in terms of what we did, in terms of producing oil and gas. I wanted us to be the best in HR. I really wanted it. And it was as important to me when my HR manager won the Cherries Award as HR Manager of the Year. That was as important to me as hitting the production target or having zero safety incidents. So I just wanted that compelling sense of do your best right across the business. And I would say at the end of the year, in the first town hall in January, we had a good year last year, but that's history now. So what we're looking for? We're looking for really good HR programs coming out. I want successful drilling programs. I want this, I want that. So it had to be across the business. I didn't want any department feeling lower than the other. Does that make sense?
It does actually make sense. And I was actually going to ask you, do you really think that MDs of a significant company has only a limited shelf life?
It's not necessarily that the individual's got a limited shelf life. It's what the business can at times tolerate. And there's some long-serving MDs. So, for instance, in Total, the MDs got shifted every 3 years.
Okay.
And it's except, and you get burnout. You know, if you're given everything into it, understand that you know you're burning yourself out. And the last year, the travel alone was demanding on me physically. So you've got to understand that from personal perspective, I've maybe got a finite period of time. From a business perspective, can I keep the business fresh? Can I keep challenging them? Can we do this? Can we do that? So, I don't know what that finite period of time is for an MD. It depends on the individual and it depends on the organization. But you can't go on forever, that's for sure.
Do you not think so? Not as MD? Because it must be a very challenging role.
It is, but it's equally, it can be the most enjoyable and the best role in the world. But then you can look at yourself and go into your office and think, that shouldn't have happened when somebody's been injured. And if an MD doesn't feel bad when somebody's injured, then there shouldn't be an MD. So it's a fantastic role. And I was very, very fortunate to hold that role. I never thought I would. And I never set out my stall to be an MD. I didn't. But having sat in the seat for a number of years, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
I'm going to ask you one final question. So if you could turn back time, would you change anything?
I have to say no. And I've crossed swords with many people, but we always shook hands afterwards. And I think that's very, very important. Business is business. Friendship's friendship, be it a professional friendship or a close friendship. But no, I've been very lucky, very, very fortunate. And I used to get teased from my HR manager that I have imposter syndrome, because I always thought it was going to get found out as not being up to the job.
I could ask you about a ton of questions about that, actually. But I'm going to leave it there in that last note. That's all the questions I have today. I would like to thank Ray for your time. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening and see you next week. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, I'd like to gently encourage you to leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with another person. You can also follow me on LinkedIn or via my website, www.michellefraserconsultancy.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week.